It's What's New from WBAA Classical and WBAA.org. I'm John Clare. The first published use of the word multitask appeared in an IBM paper describing the capabilities of the IBM System 360 in 1965. We might think of multitasking as a short-order cook, keeping several orders memorized while frying eggs, flipping pancakes, taking orders at the counter, and refilling coffee. We'll hear from a musician who conducts, composes, and records with the greatest of ease, the multitasking maestro, José Cerebrier, on today's What's New. José Cerebrier was born in Montevideo, Uruguay, of Russian and Polish parents. At age 9, he started to study the violin, and at the age of 11 made his conducting debut.
I think you could very easily make a living as a conductor and never have to worry about writing a note, but you do still. Is there a need to express these notes, these works?
Oh, yes, but I write less now because I'm more selective. When I was very, very young, when I was a teenager, I wrote like there was no stop, that there will be no tomorrow. I didn't know I was going to live past 20, I guess, so I wrote, you know, everything I could think of, and unusual things like a saxophone quartet and woodwind quintets and woodwind trio and so on, and without worrying whether I was copying myself or not. Now, that's a danger for many composers and artists in general. Writers, painters can do that. Unconsciously or consciously, they copy themselves. They find a formula, and then the next piece is very easy to go back to that formula because it solves problems to do that. So now I try not to repeat myself and to write, if possible, a new piece each time, which is why I write less. And time is very limited because I make my living, so to say, conducting. So I'm conducting everybody else's music. I don't have a problem, however, forgetting everybody else's music and writing my own. And regardless of whether I write, as I did, as everybody has at one time or another, 12-tone music or aleatoric music, it always sounds like my music, regardless of the idiom I use.
Let's hear Variations on a Theme from Childhood by José Cerebrier. Laurent de Schenedeck is the bassoonist with the Toulouse National Chamber Orchestra on What's New. Variations on a Theme from Childhood by our guest, composer and conductor José Cerebrier. He was joined by the Toulouse National Chamber Orchestra and bassoonist Laurent de Schenedeck on What's New. Find out more and hear our interview on WBAA.org. When José Cerebrier was 21 years old, Leopold Stokowski hailed him as the greatest master of orchestral balance. I ask him how this moniker came about from one of the great conductors and organists.
Philadelphia Orchestra in the great Stokowski days, he didn't want risers for the brass so that the brass could compete properly with the strings. I mean, the brass is so much louder than and percussion than the rest of the orchestra. He felt that if you put them up in risers, the sound cuts across. By putting them in the same level as the strings, then there is a chance that you can hear the strings. Throughout his life, he experimented with positioning the orchestra in different ways so as to get the best possible balance. But I was very flattered that he felt I knew something about balance, which was, in my case, mostly instinctive and mostly what I really learned from him and a few other. I was so lucky, you know, when I arrived in America, it was the end of a great era of conductors. I was too young, too late coming to hear personally Toscanini and to watch him. Or Fritz Reiner for that matter, but just in time to work with Stokowski, to study with Pierre Monteux. Then to work for several years with George Zell. I must not forget my real conducting teacher, Antal Dorati, who in Minneapolis for 2 years, who was also a great balance master. But going back to Stokowski's organ background, obviously he must have been a fantastic organist because that was his first job in America. He came to America to be the organist in one of the biggest cathedrals in New York. And part of his great conducting technique, I think, was in trying to imitate the great organ sound. And you hear it in his fantastic transcription of the Toccata and Fugue and many of the other pieces that appear in this Naxos recording. By the way, this Naxos recording is just coming out now. I'm so proud of it. The four volumes that came out before are great. The Bournemouth Symphony played it in such a way that the players felt that Stokowski's spirit must have been there in the hall inspiring us. I mean, they were unbelievable. The head of the Stokowski Society, which inspired these recordings, a wonderful gentleman based in London, Edward Johnson, he came up with his compilation and he suggested to Klaus Heyman, the owner and CEO of Naxos, to have yet one more compilation with the very best of all four CDs. I mean, they're all great, but these are the real hits. And when I heard this volume that just came out, I couldn't believe it. They are really, really fantastic, especially starting with the Toccata and Fugue, which originally I was afraid to record because there are so many other versions of this work. But this, I have to not humbly say that this is the best one. And then all the others, I mean, the Mussorgsky, everything else, Tchaikovsky is there. It's just a great, great recording. I'm very proud of it.
From the best of compilation of Stokowski transcriptions on Naxos, José Cerebre conducts the Bournemouth Symphony in Luigi Boccherini's Minuet on What's New. Transcribed for orchestra by Leopold Stokowski, we heard the Menuet by Luigi Boccherini with Bournemouth Symphony and José Cerebre. Find out more about what's new at WBAA.org, including playlists and podcasts. I'm your host, John Clare.
There have been four amazing releases of these Stokowski transcriptions, and now sort of the cream of the crop. The cover is a charming picture of you and the maestro over some music, and you both have this wonderful look. I'm curious, is this one of your pieces? Is this the first symphony
yes.
you have in the score?
No.
Because
no.
It's not.
Well, the first symphony Stokowski premiered when I was 17. He did the first concert of his last orchestra, the American Symphony, at Carnegie Hall. He wanted to open the season with one of my works. This is an interesting anecdote. I couldn't write the work fast enough. I mean, he told me in August for the opening in September. So I took a movement from my second symphony, which was called Funeral March. It wasn't meant as a death of someone, it was more philosophical than that, but he, being almost 90, he didn't like the idea of conducting a funeral march. So he asked me, I want to do this piece, but what would you call it? I got a hint, so I changed the title to Elegiac Poem. So the piece he's looking at in that photograph is my elegiac poem in preparation for the opening concert, the first concert of Stokowski with his new orchestra, his last orchestra, the American Symphony. And I remember that he called himself and said, would you like to come over? We need to have a picture together for the opening concert of the season. I was very surprised because Stokowski hated to have his picture taken. And I remember a few years later, he was conducting in Oslo. And as it so happened, this is after I stopped working with him many years later, he was like 94. And the next concert was mine. So I went a few days early to hear his concert. During the rehearsals, a player in the orchestra took his photograph. He stopped the rehearsal, took the camera out of the photographer's hand and said, you are not allowed to take my picture, and removed all the pictures. But he liked it when it was planned, I guess, and he could then approve them. By the way, unrelated, I should tell you, when I met Madame Prokofiev, Prokofiev's widow, in Paris, long time ago. She was already also 89. And the RCA Records had arranged a photograph session because I was about to record Sam Prokofiev. And I went to Paris especially. And she fussed with the photographer. No, no, she said, not that angle. Make sure it's my left angle, my left side. Never front photographs. And I must see the results before you publish. So must have been generational. They wanted to see the pictures to make sure they gave their best.
Yeah, way before the selfie.
Oh, yes, way before.
Picture this. Jose Cerebre on the podium with the New York Philharmonic and guitarist Sharon Isbin. They play the Concierto de Arnwith by Joaquin Rodrigo on What's New. Sharon Isbin, the soloist with the New York Philharmonic, and conductor Jose Cerebre. We heard a classic Warner recording of Joaquin Rodrigo's Concierto de Arnwith on What's New. There's more about this show online at WBAA.org. Conducting in China, and I mean, you conduct around the world, and we all hear that music is sort of the universal language, but I'm curious how often you have to have interpreters or how many languages you speak, and how do rehearsals go? I mean, obviously, you can show a staccato and you can show a very soft and a very loud. It sort of encouraged these from the players. But when it comes to actually talking, how many languages do you speak, Jose? And how many times are you with translators? Or is that a lot of English these days? Or tell us a little bit about rehearsing and conversing.
That's a great question. Because as you just say, I conduct all over the world. In Russia, almost every year. In Moscow with the Russian National Orchestra. In France, of course, in Spain, where I don't have a problem because my mother language is Spanish. But in the Czech Republic, in Nordic countries, in a Latin Finland, every year I go to Finland. So I never use a translator. First of all, unlike now, I almost never speak in rehearsals because I prepare the music from which the musicians play, the parts are called, ahead of time. I spend an incredible amount of time for each concert and each rehearsal putting every possible marking in the score, in the parts. For the strings, I mark bowings, that is, whether they play up or down, so that there is no discussion in I mean, they can be changed, but there is no discussion. Otherwise, one can lose half an hour or half a rehearsal deciding whether the violin should play up or down with their bows. For the brass, I normally change the dynamics. If it's marked triple forted, I make it softer so that the balance is better. I put phrases, breath marks, crescendos, diminuendos, so on. So there is very little left for me to say. Everything else is indicated with my hands. The only thing left is to be able to say start on bar 50, let's say, or on letter B or letter C. So before I go to some of these countries, I learn to say it in their language. Good morning, thank you, goodbye. and the letters and the numbers and the word before, the word after, and a few minimal things. Sometimes I think I speak the language, like in Moscow. The first time I went to work with a Russian national, I had learned to pronounce rather well these minimal things. So they began to speak to me long lectures in Russian. I had no idea what they were saying. The only time I had a translator and I dismissed him was my first or my second tour of China was with the Russian National Orchestra. And the first concert of the tour was at the Great Hall of the People, that huge, horrible place that seats 10,000 people. It's a marble hall. I think it was constructed by Mao in Tiananmen Square. And this was two orchestras together, the Russian National and the Chinese National Orchestra playing together. For the rehearsal, they provided me with a translator, but I will say something to the orchestra like, at bar 10, please play softer. Three words. He will give a lecture that lasts about 3 minutes. I said, no. I don't know what he said, but forget it. I managed to do it myself. So to answer your question with a long, just a few words, I don't use translators.
Well, there's always do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, right?
Yeah, that actually is very effective. You know how I got my first job in America when I was still a student? It was a small semi-professional orchestra upstate New York, the Utica Symphony. During the auditions, I didn't know that I was going to impress them by solfeggiing a passage in Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. I sang to them, played this, fa, mi, re, do, la, do, re, mi, do, si, la, fa, la, si, do, si, la, fa. They were so impressed, I got the job immediately. And you know, every music student in South America or any Latin country can do the same. But in Europe, well, in England especially, but other than France and Spain and Italy and in America, solfege is not really taught, so they were very surprised.
No surprise that Srebre's recordings of Dvorak were highly touted, noting that the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra performances that have been praised for their considerable expressivity, remarkable handling of detail, and supreme orchestral balance. Let's hear the E minor Slavonic Dance by Antonín Dvorak with José Srebre on What's New. The Slavonic Dance, Opus 72, Number 2, by Antonín Dvorak. José Srebre led the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra on What's New. Check out our playlists and podcasts of What's New online at WBAA.org. It's What's New from WBAA Classical. I'm John Clare. We're featuring the composer and conductor José Srebre. You can hear this show and our interview online at WBAA.org. From the Toccata Classics release Music for Dance, let's hear José Srebre conduct Synced by Christina Spinet on What's New. Released in July 2016, a recording of Christina Spinet's Synced from the CD Music for Dance, José Srebre conducted the St. Michael Strings on What's New. I asked José Srebre about the St. Michael Strings, who I'd not heard of before.
I got to know this wonderful group called St. Michael Strings in a tiny city in Finland, in St. Michael's. You know, every small city and large city in Finland has at least one orchestra. It's fantastic. It's the most musical country I know. St. Michael Strings, I got to know them about 8 years ago maybe, because they played my flute concerto with tango before it was recorded in Australia by the great Australian Chamber Orchestra with Sharon Bezali. They invited me to go there, to St. Michael, and we became immediate friends. I've been back to work with them every year. And when they asked me to make a recording, I came up with this kind of esoteric program. One of the tracks, actually, is my own adagio. It gives a name to the record. Another track is a work by young American composer Christina Spinet.
It was a discovery for me because I thought I knew all your cycles, all your Dvorak, all your amazing recordings. But this was a brand new one for me, and I was tickled to discover it. That leads me to the question of score study. And you conduct so much. You are with so many great orchestras, and it's not like it's just you're on tour with a string orchestra or that you're together with a Baroque group or you're there with a film score and the same group. So players are changing. The music is changing. The halls are changing. That's a lot of different things and all sorts of, I imagine, flights. We all know what travel's like these days. So how much time do you have to depend on that score study? And are you at the piano or do you pick up the violin? Do you have Carol come and sing with you? You know, tell us a little bit about your score preparation because you do so much.
That's a great question because that's the key to everything, the preparation. It's all about being prepared. You know, it's like in a humble way, like a general going to war. They can't just start out and hoping for the best. They have to plan. So planning means planning the rehearsals. I look at each score for a long time, if I have a long time, and then plan what needs to be rehearsed first, usually the most difficult passages, so that by the time I play the piece in its entirety, it goes very smoothly. But I mark in the score entrances. For example, suppose a cymbal player has 300 bars rest before he crashes with a big cymbal crash. You know, they will have a heart attack counting bars. So I mark in my score, a special marking, please bring to myself, show the cymbal player when he has to play. In fact, I sometimes show with my fingers, two, meaning two bars to go, one bar to go now. So that's part of it, marking when an instrument or a group of players do not perform for 30, 40, 60 bars to signal them when they have to play. That's the technical part. Then comes the most important part, to make music out of it, to find out what the composer wanted, what he meant, and how to communicate with the listeners, be it a public concert or a recording, how to make a story out of it, a drama. Even if it's esoteric, even if it's non-literal music, like Baroque composers, still there is, it has to communicate. And that comes after one prepares the work. And your question is, when do I find the time to do it? I have to find the time to do it. I don't remember ever recording something or conducting a concert where I wasn't prepared. Now, recording is the most difficult because most recordings that I do, and I've made over 300, are done without prior rehearsals. We just go to the studio, I say good morning, and there we go. And I don't use a red light. Most artists use this red and green light. Red light means we are recording. Green light means you can relax, rehearse. I record everything. From the moment I say good morning until we leave, everything gets recorded. Because sometimes the first reading happens to be the best, when everyone is concentrated the most. And sometimes when you keep repeating and repeating to get better, it tends to relax too much and goes down.
Let's hear a work by José Cerebre from a release called Adagio with the St. Michael Strings. This is the eponymous Adagio by José Cerebre on What's New. Adagio by our guest today, José Cerebre. He conducted the St. Michael Strings on What's New. You can hear more interviews and podcasts online at WBAA.org. Cerebre was first introduced to the Finnish orchestra we just heard when they programmed his flute concerto. It's been recorded by Sharon Bazali and the Australian Chamber Orchestra with Richard Tognetti. Let's hear the flute concerto with tango on What's New. Flute concerto with tango, played by the Australian Chamber Orchestra, Richard Tognetti, their leader, and soloist Sharon Bazali on What's New. It's a work from 2008 by José Cerebre.
You can hear more interviews and podcasts online at WBAA.org. I asked Maestro Cerebri about a composer I wasn't familiar with, Xiaogang Ye.
Well, he's now, in the last year or so, become the most prominent composer living in China, by far. About a year ago, the Detroit Symphony came to New York especially to do an entire concert of Xiaogang Ye's music. I finally learned to pronounce his name, by the way. He took some practice. Xiaogang Ye is the last name. The surname is Y-E, Ye. And he's extremely prolific and very well known in China for many reasons. One is that he's head of the National Conservatoire in Beijing. He's head of the union. They have a union now, musicians' union in China, and he's president of that. He organized it. And many other things I don't know about. Oh, yes, he's the founder of the Beijing Modern Music Festival. And I am conducting the opening concert of that festival in just a few weeks, in two weeks, in fact, from today, at their fantastic new hall. Anyway, I came across his music when the Detroit Symphony played an entire concert of his works. So I heard it, and I was so fascinated by it, I approached him, and I told him I'd like to play one of his works in London, where he was unknown. We played this violin concerto, The Last Paradise. It was a huge success. Then he asked me to make a record of his music. That's how that happened.
This is a score from José Cerebré, They Rode Into the Sunset, music for an imaginary film meant for a Bollywood picture that never came to be. Cerebré conducts the Bournemouth Symphony and Chorus on What's New. They Rode Into the Sunset, music for an imaginary film played by the Bournemouth Symphony and Chorus, led by our guest, composer and conductor José Cerebré. Hear our interview with José and more at WBAA.org.
Well, congratulations. These are amazing new releases, and we can't wait for so much more. The first 300 or so have been great. We can't wait for the next 300, Maestro.
You're very, John, great pleasure to speak with you again. All the best.
What's New is a production of WBAA Classical, a listener-supported broadcast service of Purdue University. Production assistance from Erica Yan and Kevin Howard, the content director and executive producer is Greg Estraba. I'm your host and producer, John Clare. Thanks for listening to What's New.